Buenos días. Hoy tenemos acá el placer de recibir al profesor Noel Struchiner. Como todos saben, Noel Struchiner es profesor de Teoría del Derecho de la Pontificia Universidad Católica de Río de Janeiro. Y es un gran placer presentarlo porque somos profesores de la PUC Río. Estoy acá como profesor visitante por un par de años. Y tenemos así la felicidad de recibir un brasileño más. Hoy probablemente la presentación va a ser en inglés, pero como todos saben, pueden hacer las preguntas en inglés, en castellano y catalán, y como desearen hacer. El título portugués también. Portugués también. El título de la presentación no es Just Say No to Empathy, Making the Case for Autistic Decision Making. Y sin tardar más, paso la palabra para Noel. Bueno, esté a vontade. 40 minutos más o menos, está bien. 45, bueno.
Thank you very much for this lovely introduction. And it's a pleasure to be here and to meet all of you. It's a pleasure to be with Adrian again. It's a pleasure to see Luis again. And I changed the title a little bit of the paper. I'm actually pretty much undecided about what the title should be because it's still a work in progress. It's actually very different from what I usually do. In Brazil, I teach courses with Adrian in traditional legal theory. And with Professor Danilo, who is also here, we have been talking a lot about rules, about the nature of rules, both in language and in law. And he talks a lot about ordinary language philosophy. He talks a lot about Wittgenstein, a lot about Austin, and we give courses together. And I talk about Raz, and I talk about Hart, and I talk about Schauer. And one thing we notice is that we have been giving very little space to the discussion about how emotions affect decision making and how emotions affect the understanding of rules and things like that. And one issue that has interested us and is the issue about weakness of the will and akrasia. But because we are too acratic and because we have too much weakness of the will, we have not been dedicating ourselves too much. So I started to discuss a little more about, I thought that we should break our weakness of the will and discuss the role of emotions in decision making, and this is just the first try at it. Janaína suggested that I give my talk in English, and so I'll do so. I would like to start my presentation on a very serious note. In the original contemporary classic, The Karate Kid, 1984 version, the protagonist, Daniel LaRusso, leaves New Jersey with his mother to live in California, where she has found a new job. Needless to say that Daniel rapidly discovers that times will be tough for him in his new town. The karate students of Cobra Kai Dojo and fellow high school classmates will not leave him alone, always bullying him and beating him up. The only way out is for Daniel to learn karate himself. And he does this in record time with the help of Mr. Miyagi. Curiously, he learns this by painting fences and other things and waxing cars. In the last scene of the movie, Daniel is in the finals of the karate tournament, fighting his biggest foe, Johnny Lawrence, Cobra Kai's best fighter and former champion of the tournament. To make matters worse and shed some drama, Daniel's leg is hurt from an illegal move applied by another Cobra Kai student with the blessing of the Cobra Kai evil sensei, John Kreese, who told his pupil to put Daniel out of commission. This is the dialogue between Johnny Lawrence and his sensei, John Kreese, right before the final match. Kreese says, "Sweep the leg." Johnny stares at him in shock. Kreese says, "Do you have a problem with that?" Johnny Lawrence says, "No, sensei." Kreese says, and this is probably one of the most famous scenes in the movie, "No mercy." If John Kreese had said, instead of "no mercy," "no sympathy," "no compassion," no soft heartness, no warmness, no tenderness. Don't be moved. We would have understood him equally well. In many of Batson's experiments, and Batson is a psychologist who has done a lot of experiments on empathy, these words form a cluster and are taken to be empathy adjectives. There are many ways in which these words can be defined and differentiated, but it is possible to find many resemblances, many family resemblances among them in ordinary usage. I will not be concerned with philosophy of language here, discussing the fine distinctions and resemblances among these words, but I will concentrate my efforts on the question of empathy. So if he had said no empathy in the movie, we would have understood him equally well. To be more precise, I will be speaking against empathy as a source for moral and legal decision making. This is not a very easy task, and it's perhaps very counterintuitive to speak against empathy. And when we had Jesse Prince speaking in Brazil, I said, if you're going to be speaking against empathy, you're going to have a very hard time. And he said, speaking against empathy is sort of like speaking against sex or speaking against ice cream. It's something that is very hard to do. So my objective, my aim, is to speak against empathy without being identified with John Kreese by the end of my presentation. Is it okay if I just, I think I put the wrong PowerPoint on, so if I may just change for a quick second. It was right after all. I made a mistake. So if I'm going to be speaking against empathy, then what I need to do is to give a definition or to explain empathy in a more precise way. I need to say what I mean by empathy. And this is something that is hard to do because the meaning of empathy is highly controversial and the word empathy is very ambiguous. Therefore, the definition I am proposing here is only one of many possibilities, but it does correspond to the way in which some philosophers and psychologists have understood the concept of empathy. So other people such as de Waal and Barnett and Berger, Eisenberg and Strayer, Darwall, a philosopher, Nichols, Shawn Nichols, Goldman, Hume, and Adam Smith have used explanations of empathy, and in the case of Hume and Adam Smith, of sympathy, that are close to what I mean by empathy. So my proposal is not a totally stipulative definition, as I said, thought up from scratch, although others may favor other explanations and definitions. So let's get it more clear. Empathy, or what I mean by empathy, empathy is not the name of a specific emotion, but refers rather to the experience of another's emotional state, whatever that state might be. So empathy, in my sense, involves a matching of emotions. So you can see on the pictures there that the people are having the same emotion. They are sharing an emotion. And it's more than the mere sharing of emotion. Empathy is a matter of feeling the emotion we take another person to have. It involves some form of emotion contagion or emotion catching. So empathy is not the name of a specific emotion. Empathy is a placeholder for whatever it is that the other emotion that the other person is having. And it involves some kind, it's not only matching, but it involves some kind of catching as well. And this catching can occur through more sophisticated means or less sophisticated means. So modes of empathy acquisition can be more primitive, pre-verbal, and automatic. And these modes, as presented by Hoffman, are mimicry, conditioning, and direct association, or by more sophisticated mean, verbally mediated association and perspective taking are these more sophisticated means. I will not be talking much about these modes of acquisition because they don't interest me too much for the purposes of the paper, but it's important just to mention that all of these modes can be presented, and it's the end result that interests me more, the matching of emotion, and that this this catching of emotion occurs through some kind of catching, and that this catching can be more sophisticated or less sophisticated, more automatic, less automatic, more deliberative. So I'll be speaking about affective empathy and not cognitive empathy. Cognitive empathy involves the mere understanding of the other's emotion. What I have in mind involves more than the mere understanding of the other's emotion, but involves also having the emotion that the other person has. What I have in mind when I talk about empathy is quite similar to what, at least compatible with what Hume said about sympathy. As in strings equally wound up, the motion of one communicates itself to the rest. So all the affections rarely pass from one person to another and beget correspondent movements in every human creature. When I see the effects of passion in the voice and gesture of any person, my mind immediately passes from these effects to their causes and forms such a lively idea of the passion as is presently converted into the passion itself. In like manner, when I do perceive the causes of any emotion, my mind is conveyed to the effects and is actuated with a like emotion. And this is Adam Smith on empathy. Not on empathy, but on sympathy. By the imagination, we place ourselves in his situation. We conceive ourselves enduring all the same torments. We enter, as it were, into his body and become in some measure the same person with him, and thence form some idea of his sensations, and even feel something which, though weaker in degree, is not altogether unlike them. When we have read a book or poem so often that we can no longer find any amusement in reading it by ourselves, we can still take pleasure in reading it to a companion. To him, it has all the graces of novelty. We enter into the surprise and admiration which it naturally excites in him, but which it is no longer capable of exciting in us. We consider all the ideas which it presents rather in the light in which they appear to him than in that in which they appear to ourselves. And we are amused by sympathy with his amusement, which thus enlivens our own. So even though the way Smith and Hume characterize sympathy does not capture all the ways of emotion catching that I mentioned, there are a lot of points in contact with what I'm describing as empathy. So in the first part of the paper, and I'll not be talking about this because it would take too long, in the first part of the paper, I tried to make the case that empathy is not necessary for morality. But we have to tease out what this means. What does it mean to say that empathy is not necessary for morality? And I try to divide this claim into three different claims. And I say that empathy is not necessary for moral judgment. And so it's not the case that every moral judgment is constituted by empathy or that empathy is the causal precursor of every moral judgment. And the second claim is that empathy is not necessary for moral development. So it's a more diachronic and not a synchronic claim. And the third claim is that empathy is not necessary for moral motivation. And here I use a lot of Jesse Prince's arguments, and he has two papers in which he speaks against empathy, so I really claim no originality in this part of my presentation. So we come to the normative question. The fact that empathy is not necessary for moral judgment, moral development, or moral motivation does not mean that it cannot play a function in these domains, only that is not required to do so. If empathy is possible but not necessary in any of the ways described, then should we cultivate an empathy-based moral system? Is empathy normatively desirable? In order to answer, we need to adopt a realistic approach and investigate psychological facts about empathy. Empirical moral, so this is the place where normative ethics and empirical moral psychology meet. Empirical moral psychology furnishes the constraints and feasibility criteria for normative considerations. So it's a good idea to have in mind Owen Flanagan's principle of minimal psychological realism. Make sure when constructing a moral theory or projecting a moral ideal that the character, decision processing, and behavior prescribed are possible or are perceived to be possible for creatures like us. After all, what good would it do if we were to develop moral rules, guidelines, and recommendations that no one could apply? And how fit would this moral proposal be if it did not take into account the ways in which we actually make decisions and the common mistakes in which we incur? Sure, it sounds nice to say be empathic or show some empathy, but what are the actual limitations of empathy when applied in decision making? What is required is that we investigate empathy's shortcomings, biases, and pitfalls in order to find out if it is all it is cut out to be. So here we're trying to bring a little bit of the spirit of experimental philosophy to more traditional questions of philosophy and to normative jurisprudence as well. And so this was the symbol, the symbol that a lot of experimental philosophers used when the movement just came about. It was the burning armchair, the idea that we should leave the armchair and that philosophers should do experiments. So we have two pictures on the top of burning armchairs. I think the movement is now becoming a little different and it's becoming a little more soft. And I think they would accept now the armchairs on wheels, and the idea is that you have to combine experimental investigations and you have to experiments with the armchairs. That is, you don't leave the armchair. You do experiments, and the idea is that you go back to your armchair to do conceptual analysis, and that the experiments also start from the armchair, the designing of the experiments, so there's a lot of thinking that must be done in the armchair as well. So you have the Harley Davidson armchair and the other armchair on wheels over there. And this is a book that we have recently organized in Brazil, and you have Kant leaving the armchair unsatisfied with his a priori considerations, and he's put on a lab coat and he's going to do experiments, and we hope that he will come back to the armchair later and that he will think better about his normative considerations. It was a book that was organized with many of current experimental philosophers. So in this section, I will investigate the psychological facts that present hindrances to the use of empathy for moral decision-making. My list is tentative and not exhaustive, and because my interests focus on legal decision-making more specifically, I will only call attention to those drawbacks that impinge not only on moral decision-making, but are at the same time detrimental to legal decision-making. After all, normative adjudication theory, the rubric under which my discussion about legal decision-making falls, is subject to the same psychological constraints that pertain to normative ethics. So, first of all, let's take on empathy's fragility as a motivator. As mentioned, actually, I didn't mention this, but it's mentioned in the paper. Batson says that empathy is a fragile flower easily crushed by self-concern. This is a big problem if we expect judges to be deviating from grotesquely unjust laws. However, my focus today is not on gravely unjust systems of rules, but rather reasonable and just systems, which have done away with morally abhorrent rules or moral abhorrent laws. And in environments such as these, we no longer carry flagrant unjust norms. The problems associated with empathy seem to provide reasons not to deviate from the law. Empathy-based judging may not be a sound move. So I'm arguing against the deviating from clear-cut legal rules because of empathy. Empathy is subject to easy manipulation. Prince corroborates this by pointing to Olga Tucidi's work on empathy manipulation in mock trials. In these mock trial situations, the jury sentencing was susceptible to the expressed emotions of victims and defendants. If the victim was talented in expressing emotions of sadness, then the defendant got harsher sentences. If the defendant was talented at expressing emotions, then he got lighter sentences. The expression of sadness by the transgressor increased reported feelings of empathy and decreased suggested punishment. The problem is that some people are better at expressing emotions than others, and the facial expressions may be just superficial cues that do not represent the deepest felt emotions. Concentration on expression of emotions may lead us astray from the actual facts and the actual harm produced. In some cases, empathy-induced altruism can actually harm the person who is the focus of the altruistic act. Sometimes empathy is used unwisely. As Batson says, empathy can promote a warm heart when you need a cool head. His example is the case of a surgeon who avoids operating on close kin. Empathic concern on his part would be so great that it could cause an otherwise steady hand to shake abruptly. In law, a judge may succumb to the claims of the party with which he feels empathy and disregard if what is being asked for will in fact be useful for the victim. In Brazil, it has become ever more common for people to demand expensive treatments and medicines through the judiciary. These treatments are often ones that are not contemplated through the unitary health system, which establishes the legal entitled treatments and medications. So we have the unitary health system, and the unitary health system establishes very clearly and beforehand what are the treatments and what are the medications that people can use. And people have been frequently asking for medications that are not on the list of the unitary health system. If the judge empathizes with the claimant, he may grant the treatment without making sure that the treatment in question is actually appropriate for the victim, thus incurring an error. And we have many decisions that this has been followed through afterwards, and we have seen this, that the medication that was granted was not an adequate medication for the person. According to Hoffman, empathy can lead to familiarity bias. He splits familiarity bias into in-group bias, friendship bias, and similarity bias. As he puts it, though people empathize with almost anyone in distress, they empathize more with kin, friends, and their own ethnic group. Both Hoffman and Prince point to studies that show this type of bias. Their repercussion for law and judicial decision-making are obvious. Judges, even though they are unaware of it, may favor people who are somehow like them, going as far as deviating from a clear-cut legal norm in order to grant their claims. As legal realists point out a long time ago, these judges will not justify their decisions by saying that they were favoring someone who was like them or who they identified with, but will find some post hoc rationalization legal prop as a legitimate way to present their unconscious bias. According to Batson, existing research does not support the familiarity, friendship, or similarity is necessary for empathy-induced altruism. So in the end, for him, for Batson, it all comes down to a preference. The teacher may have a preference for the good students and may empathize with them, while it is the case that the worst students are the ones that require the most help. The liking or disliking of a person can make a big difference. Franz de Waal, in his latest book, The Age of Empathy, tells us how Nazis were very sentimental towards their family members, while at the same time having lampshades made out of human skin and being capable of exterminating the masses. But if empathy is attached to preference, to predilections, and if predilections are often arbitrary, then empathy can be selective, highly selective, in a whimsical manner. Prince presents the example of a boxing match in which the boxers are getting it on, punching each other back and forth, even though the same violent acts are happening. Even though the same violent acts are happening, I only feel empathy for the boxer I'm cheering for. So my previous arbitrary predilections are guiding empathy. And here I have the pictures of an MMA fight between a Brazilian and a Canadian. And you can see how the Canadian ended up in the end of the fight. And I have to confess that I felt no empathy towards the Canadian. And while the Brazilian, who's on the bottom there in that part of the fight, was getting hit, I felt every blow. In law, if a judge already has a horse in a certain race, it will make it much harder or impossible to generalize his empathy to all parties involved. Think of hot issues such as abortion. Empathy is probably the biggest impediment to the adoption of the general point of view or the view from nowhere, and can take away or subtract from the legal point of view as well. Empathy is also subject to petty biases, such as cuteness effects. Prinz recalls an experiment by Batson in which he shows that college students were more likely to empathize with children, dogs, and puppies than their own peers. This means that cuteness effects may be even stronger than the effects produced by similarity and in-group bias. Slovak has an interesting example of a case of a dog that's stranded aboard a tanker adrift in the Pacific, and apparently $48,000 was spent on trying to rescue that dog. And critics spoke against these rescue attempts, alleging that the money could be better spent on children that go to bed hungry. In Brazil, the same powers of cuteness effects were well spread, expressed in a popular song. There's a popular song, and Adrian probably knows this song, that was written by Léo Jaime, and it's a rockabilly song, and the main chorus of the song goes, "Exchange your dog for a poor kid." So we can see the cuteness effect being presented there as well in a more anecdotal manner. In law, judges may be gentler with the good-looking white-collar criminal while being rough to the bad-looking toothless hoodlum. Judicial decision-makers may favor parties such as older women, kids, even if reason and even if legal reason is not on their side. While it is not uncontroversial if empathy is prone to proximity effects, it is agreed upon that empathy is subject to salience effects, and that this is extremely relevant in the courtroom. Empathy works at its best when events and victims are more concrete and vivid. The easier it is to personalize, the easier it is for empathy to kick in. Inasmuch as physical proximity is useful for vividness, empathy will also be subject to proximity effects. Hoffman refers to saliency as the here and now bias, and says that Richard Posner speaks about the same phenomenon when he talks about the availability heuristic in the courtroom. So this is what Posner says about the availability heuristic. He says that it occurs when we give too much weight to vivid, immediate impressions, and hence pay too much attention to the feelings, interests, and humanity of the parties in the courtroom, and too little to absent persons likely to be affected by the decision. You don't need much empathy to be moved by a well-represented litigant pleading before you. The challenge to the empathetic imagination is to be moved by thinking or reading about the consequences of the litigation for absent, often completely unknown, or even unborn others who will be affected by your decision. And I think that in a certain way, Posner is right about this difficulty. I think he's wrong in presupposing that this can actually happen. I think he's assuming bad psychology when he claims that even the possibility that judges can generalize the empathy the way that he pretends judges to generalize. It is important to investigate this further, since salience has a direct relationship to two of the biggest drawbacks for the use of empathy in morality as well as in normative adjudication theory. As Batson makes clear, empathy-based decision-making can lead to actions and results contrary to those dictated by principles of justice and fairness, as well as being harmful to the common good. Let's tackle them one at a time, and let's start by discussing how empathy is a menace to principles of fairness and justice. Sure, empathy is a pro-social motive. Batson has made this point loud and clear over and over again. Empathy can and does induce altruism. Does this mean that empathy is necessarily worth striving for? It is commonly thought that whatever morality might be, it is the opposite of egoism. Altruism, or acting in order to improve the welfare of another as an ultimate goal, can hardly be identified with egoism. If altruism is not egoism, then it must be moral. And because empathy induces altruism, empathy is a good thing as well. However, altruism is not always good. The reasoning is fallacious, and the jump or association of empathy to morality occurs too quickly. Empathy is neither moral nor immoral, but amoral. In certain situations, empathy as a pro-social motive can work against fairness or justice. So just to take one experiment by Batson, it's an experiment where participants were placed in the awkward position of playing God. They first listened to an interview with a 10-year-old girl named Sherry, who had slow progressing terminal illness. Some participants listened to the interview in a low empathy condition, while others were primed to feel great empathy by being asked to imagine how Sherry was feeling. After hearing the interview, participants had the chance to take Sherry out of a waiting list and to place her into an immediate treatment group ahead of other children who either had a more severe terminal illness or had been waiting longer for treatment. In the low empathy condition, only 33% chose to move Sherry. But in the high empathy condition, 73% chose to move her. In situations of high empathy, partiality towards the target of empathy can thus compromise both procedural and substantive fairness. And something similar happened in Brazil. We had the case of a blaster, somebody who works on detonation with dynamites and explosives to detonate rocks, and he worked for the government, and he said that he worked in a dangerous job and that he should have a higher salary, and he was already retired when he did this, and he was granted by the Superior Labor Court, they decided that he had the right to that salary, but that the state didn't have the money to pay it right there, so they so he won, but he won through a writ of mandamus. So he was going to get it whenever whenever the state had the money available to pay him. So there's an order for paying this. And he went to court again because he had prostate cancer. So he went to court again and he asked to advance his place in the line for receiving the payment. And he was granted that. So we have cases like this occurring in the judiciary, where judges will put people in front or ahead of others in cases of transplants and similar things. Empathy can be harmful to justice and fairness as well as to the common good. This is especially clear in social dilemma scenarios. Batson characterizes social dilemmas in the following way. People have a choice about how to allocate scarce resources, time, money, energy. And regardless of what others do, allocation to the group is the best for the group as a whole, but allocation to a single individual, oneself or another in the group, is best for that individual. And yet, if all allocations are to separate individuals, each individual is worse off than if all allocations are to the group. So the first experiment is the lottery experiment. I will skip that so that I can speak without going over my time. And I'll go straight to the second experiment. It's important to mention, though, that dilemmas set up in this way above are not infrequent. We face them when thinking about whether to recycle, to vote, pay taxes, and so on. In law, it is not uncommon for cases that imply social dilemmas to come up. And when they do, it is not unusual for judges to empathically focus on the party making the claim while neglecting the many that will be affected by his empathy-based decision. Let's stick with examples in the area of individual claims made to the judiciary for guaranteeing medical treatment and medicine. Otávio Ferraz, who is a Brazilian who lives in England, provides interesting data from 2008. In that year, also in the state of São Paulo, the state spent approximately $200 million to comply with court orders benefiting about 35,000 successful claimants. According to him, most of this amount was used for purchasing expensive drugs, many of which had to be imported and are not even registered for use in Brazil. The consequence being that the public resources are diverted, at least in part, and this is Ferraz, diverted at least in part from current or future health problems that would benefit larger and more disadvantaged groups who cannot easily access the courts to protect their claims. As a concrete example of this, Ferraz mentioned that the Ministry of Health put back a plan to vaccinate 32 million children against bacteria due to resource limitations of health budget. So there are two competing and conflicting psychological explanations for what is happening here. And what is happening here is known as the collapse of compaction. And perhaps these two competing explanations are very well represented in the works of Paul Slovak, who defends the effective triggers account, and the work of Cameron and Payne, who defend the motivated emotion regulation account. What they are discussing is the collapse of compassion, as I said, and to get clear on the collapse of compassion, maybe we should compare normative models to descriptive models. So the first normative model about valuing life would say something like this. As the number of lives increases, what we would expect, what should happen from the rational point of view, if we value all lives equally, is that as we start to lose more lives, the value of losing those lives also increases in accord with the value with the lives lost. So we'd have a linear function. Another possibility, also another normative model, would be the following. You have a linear function in the beginning, but then you have a more exponential function, because as soon as you start to lose a lot of lives, this could be the end of a whole society or a whole community. So you value even more each life that is lost after a certain point. But what do we see from the descriptive point of view? So these are normative models, but what we see from the descriptive point of view? What we see from the descriptive point of view are things like this, such as the psychophysical model describing how saving humans' lives may actually be valued. What we see is that initially the lives are highly valued, and then the curve starts to stabilize. We don't value each life again. We don't increase the value for each life lost. So we would need a very high stimulus for things to grow in that case. And but what Slovak shows is that even when we have two people or a very small amount of people, as soon as the number starts to increase, the collapse of compassion starts to show itself. We start to value less and less and less until we simply go numb to all those lives that are being lost. So he calls this the collapse of compassion. So the collapse of compassion can either mean the incapacity of increase in the value, or just the radical decline of the value of lives lost. And to show the collapse of compassion, they use a lot of different interesting experiments. Most of these are with regards to donations. So in the first one, he shows that when you have an identifiable life compared to statistical information, or identifiable with statistical information, that people who are asked to donate money, they will donate more to the identifiable victim than they will to statistical information, without pictures and without being a single person, or to identifiable pictures combined with statistics. As you can see, identifiable with statistics is very close to statistical information by itself. And there are other experiments, and this was done in Israel. It was done by Kogut and Ritov. And they show that even when the victims are all identifiable. So you have 8 identifiable victims and 1 identifiable victims, then different groups of people will donate more to one person rather than to eight people. And this was another experiment done by Slovak, and he shows that even with 2 people, we see this effect happening. So we have the chance to donate to Rokia or to Musa separately, or we can donate to both Rokia and Musa. And what we see is that donations are much higher for Rokia by herself or for Musa by himself than for Rokia and for Musa together. So there are a few competing explanations about the undergirding psychological processes capable of accounting for the cases above, but 2 seem most promising, as I said. Unfortunately, these proposals are incompatible, and not being an experimental psychology myself, I don't know what to make of this incompatibility. The first explanation is the affective triggers account. One prominent version of this account was given by Paul Slovak while trying to explain why people will go to great efforts to help one person in need, but will ignore the masses, allowing genocide to happen over and over again. He cites Mother Teresa, who says, "If I looked at the mass, I will never act. If I look at the one, I will." Even more dramatically, he suggests that the collapse of compassion can occur whenever you have more than one person in need. It seems that in order for empathy to play its role, both imagery and attention are crucial. Some studies suggest that imagery and feelings are lacking when victims are treated as numbers or statistics, human beings with their tears dried off. Other studies point out that attention loses focus and intensity when targeted at groups of individuals, being greater for individuals. Individuals are viewed as a psychological coherent unit, while groups are not. The best chances of generating empathy will be for the single victim, human or other animal, with a face and a name. This is what the identifiable victim effect tells us. But identifiability is not the only factor for reducing empathy. The number of victims seems to be even more important. Research demonstrates that when comparing 2 victims, one identified and the other unidentified, there will likely be empathy with the first and not the latter, even if the identification does not convey any substantial information about the victim. However, if comparing the empathy generated by one individual victim to a group of identified victims, as in the experiment done in Israel, the former comes out on top. Slovak goes into more details and explains this in terms of dual process theories and System 1 and System 2. These tell us that there are 2 distinct mechanisms for interacting with the world. System 1 is intuitive, automatic, nonverbal, narrative, and experiential, while System 2 is analytical, deliberative, verbal, and rational. System 1 is the experiential system. The experiential system has an affective basis. And underlying the role of affect is the importance of images and attentions. Single identifiable victims invoke System 1. They trigger the affective system. For multiple victims, it is extremely hard or maybe even impossible to generate empathy. System 1 does not kick in. The second explanation is espoused by Cameron and Payne. They reject the affective triggers account and hold instead the motivated emotion regulation account. For them, it is not the case that the collapse of compassion is due to incapacity of System 1, the affective system, to respond to multiple victims. Through a series of experiments, they tried to show that what really influences empathy or not are 3 factors: motivation to regulate emotions, regulation skill, and regulation instructions. In cases where people will not incur any costs, emotional or psychological, by empathizing, in cases where people are not very good at regulating emotions, and in situations where they are explicitly instructed to feel and not refrain from feeling emotions, they will empathize with the group. The collapse of compassion is not the result of the affective system's incapacity to deal with groups. I really cannot adjudicate between these competing explanations, but gladly I don't have to.
The point for my purposes in this paper is that either we are incapable of generating empathy because of the way our thinking processes are built, the affective triggers account, or it is very hard to generate empathy for multiple victims. This is the motivated emotion regulation account. Therefore, we should not be hitting heads insisting on empathy for moral and legal decision making. Posner talks about judicial empathy, which would involve taking into account or being in tune with not only the feelings of the parties in a case, but all those who are not present but may be affected by the decision. This is not realistic. Empathy is unsuited for this purpose, since it is a dyadic emotion regulating responses between two individuals, and its function is, arguably, to align the emotions of people in a close relationship. This is what Prince says. It is designed for local travel and cannot take us across the sea. This is Prince again. Empathy is an impediment for the adoption of the universal or even the general point of view. Empathy is a barrier to the adoption of the view from nowhere. We need a viable alternative that is psychologically feasible. And my bet is on autistic rule-based decision making. So I'm with Goldman, and I guess Hume as well, who believe in designing legal and institutional mechanisms that will enforce the proper responses that are not achievable through empathy. So this is Goldman. Goldman says, Hume remarks that institutions of justice would not be necessary at all if the human mind were so replete with friendship and generosity that every man has the utmost tenderness for every man and feels no more concern for his own interest than that of his fellows. In our actual state, there do seem to be limits to our benevolence and our empathic powers. These limits create the need for legal and political institutions that will be sufficiently constraining to shape the conduct of creatures like us. Here, I'll try to make the case for the contingent virtues of law when law is understood as autistic rule-based decision-making. This requires that we expound our discussion about autism as well as develop a brief account of the nature of rules. I will begin with the latter. Here, I make no claim to originality as well. I just couldn't get Roz's beer on my face so I could do a similar slide to the one I did with Prince or make myself look like Fred Schauer. But most of what I say hinges on their work. Schauer's initial take on rules is that they are simplified, generalized instantiations of deeper, more complex normative justifications. However, this is not a sufficient characterization of rules, and Schauer obviously realizes this. Since for rules to achieve their ruleness, they actually have to work like rules. Under a Rajan conception of rules, for this to happen, the formulation of the rule must preempt considerations of the background justification of the rule. I call this a Rajan conception. I don't mean to be too faithful. I mean, if you want to call it something else, call it something else. I'm not too worried about exegesis here. I mean, my purpose is to talk about two different models, and because they are inspired in Raz and Schauer about rules, then I use their pictures, but I'm not trying to be too faithful to what they said. Okay. In other words, the rule must count as an exclusionary reason, a first-order reason to act, and concomitantly, a second-order reason to refrain from considering additional reasons. Rules must claim authority and provide content-independent reasons for action. So we have the image of the person with the blinds on, the idea that you don't that rules are preemptive. The idea is that rules offer exclusionary reasons and block your access to the justifications that are behind the rules. In a Schauerian conception of rules, the rule formulation does not have to be totally opaque to the background justifications, but must offer a significant amount of resistance to the background justifications or the totality of reasons that could be invoked in the absence of the rule. So the force field and the code, and you still feel a little bit of code with the code, and the force fields offer some resistance, but it can be defeated. In both accounts, it is the language of the rule formulation, its literalness, that is doing the normative work and guaranteeing its ruleness. By being simplifications of more complex normative justifications, they are bound to present problems when applied. These are problems of over-inclusion and under-inclusion. Take, for example, showers, no dogs allowed in the restaurant rule. Perhaps the purpose or background justification for this rule is to prevent behaviors that will annoy the customers of the restaurant. However, case is not covered by the meaning of the words in the rule formulation, but supposedly covered by the background justifications, could come up, crying babies, noisy adults, brawlers, bears, and so on. There could also come up cases that are covered by the language of the rule, but that would not be covered by its background justifications, a well-training seeing eye dog, for example. Given the shortfalls of rules, the question that comes up is why treat rule formulations in ways that bring their ruleness to life? Before tackling this normative question, I want to briefly discuss some of the characteristic traits of people with autism who seem prone to have this stance towards rule. People with autism, even though they have trouble with empathy, they are not cruel, and their love for systemizing can be a good thing. They are rigid rule followers who take very seriously the literalness in which the rules are formulated. Rules gain their ruleness exactly because of the literalness that exerts great resistance, maybe absolute resistance, in face of background justifications. In sum, there's much similarity between what law tries to do and what autistic people do. Law works with rules that are repetitive and literal. Law is conservative, not in the political sense, but in the sense of being an instrument for maintaining order and stability. So, what are the normative reasons for adhering to an autistic rule account theory of adjudication? What are the virtues of rules? Why stick to rules even if everyone knows that they are just imperfect, simplified, generalizations of the background justifications being actually or potentially under or over inclusive in regard to what they say? It is commonplace to say that serious rules are more likely to permit certainty, predictability, coordination, and bringing about efficiency by means of simplifying decision making. But the obviousness of this utterance does not make it any less important. Rules do seem to have all of these virtues, which are also the virtues of systemizing. More importantly, rules are also instruments for the allocation of power. Without them, there would be no distribution or separation of powers or authority. And if you, an agent in an institutional designing scheme, were to believe that certain decision makers were more likely to err, either because of lack of expertise, lack of information, the likelihood of committing cognitive errors, or abuse of power just because of plain interested reasons, when given the prerogative of deciding by taking into account the background justification of rules or the totality of relevant reasons and facts, then you may want to design institutions that will take rules seriously. You may want to grant rule formulations their ruleness if you believe that by not granting it, judges are more likely to decide based on empathy and commit all the errors associated with empathy decision making. In judicial practice, we find different stances that are taken regarding rule formulations. These different stances represent different models of decision making and stand in a continuum between two extremes, particularism and formalism. I loosely define particularism for the purpose of this presentation to be the position according to which it is acceptable to deviate from clear legal rules to do what one believes to be right, correct, or fit for the case under consideration. The particularist does not treat rules as rules, but as mere suggestions. The particularist models of decision-making have been called by Larry Alexander and by Frederick Schauer Spike Lee models because they claim to do the right thing. When looking at the other end of the spectrum, we can find more formalistic types of decision-making models in which rule formulations are treated seriously, just like people with autism do. Why and when should System 2 make the choice, the more deliberative system, why and when should System 2 make the choice for more autistic-based models of decision-making in the law? We should realize the comparative thrust of the argument to be used in the response. Formalistic decision-making should be the choice when particularism is not to be trusted. When the comparative costs of accepting the frequency and impact of the errors produced by particularism are worse than the frequency and impact of the errors produced by formalism, then the latter is the obvious choice. particularists can do away with rules in order to apply their background justifications or to apply what they take to be the backbone of morality of the whole system of law, or to apply whatever moral theory they prefer. It is not hard to imagine people making mistakes when they take these grand endeavors upon themselves. But we should not forget that one of the major contributing factors for downplaying rules is empathy for one of the parties in the dispute. The empathy-driven result may be mistakenly taken to be the morally correct result. This is not surprising, given that empathy is so frequently conflated with morality. Empathy can also be used as an heuristic for morality, but we have seen that it is not a very reliable heuristic for all the reasons that I mentioned above. Legal rules compose a tertium quid. Legal rules, and therefore law, is not the same as morality. The results produced by law are also not coextensive with the results that would have been produced by empathy-based decision-making. However, if there is reason to believe that granting judges or other decision-makers direct access to morality will in fact be detrimental to morality, and if empathy is not a good heuristic for morality, then perhaps our bet should be on serious rules as alternative heuristics to morality. So this is inspired by Raz's service conception of law. So this is the general idea behind the service conception of law and Schauer's normative defense of rules. Law is the best viable option when it brings us the service of better approaching our moral purposes than striving towards these purposes directly. This is when law is morally justified. The strategy has been called obliquity by John Kay in a recently published book, and comprehends the idea that some things are better pursued indirectly. In this case, if we are to pursue morality indirectly, perhaps we should not do this through empathy, but we should use rules in its place. Finally, depending on the likelihood or easiness with which the particularist Spike Lee model can turn into the Sinatra model, if there is a good chance that the particularist Spike Lee model, the do the right thing model, will become in practice, the Sinatra, what matters is that I did it my way model, even if my way is the dead wrong way model, then the case has been made for sustaining autistic rule-based decision-making. It may be nice to get by with a little empathic help from our friends, but it may not be a wise idea to let some individuals get by with a little empathic help from the judges. So this is just a picture to show the irony. This is the in front of our Supreme Court in Brazil. It was the day for the awareness of, International Day for the Awareness of Autism, and they had the color blue there as a statement of the awareness of the Autism Day. And there is, on the right, you see a famous person with autism, and her name is Temple Grandin. And I think that judges should be a little more autistic in their decisions and not, if you actually read, and I have some decisions here, but if you actually read the decisions, then you would probably understand more where I'm coming from. And the quality of the decisions are at least in some cases, are very low, and a lot of decisions are being based on empathy, and I think we would prefer judges that would abide by the rules more closely. So these are some people who helped me. I mean, even though I'm speaking against empathy, I'm very empathetic with my friends, and my friends are very empathetic with me, and these are some people that helped me. So that's Fiery Cushman, and that's Walter Sinnott Armstrong in the second picture. That's Fabio, who Luis knows, another student, our group, our research group in Rio, and that's the person who made comments to my paper. Kelly Hewer made many interesting comments to my paper in Canada. And just before I thank you, I hope I have persuaded you that empathy may not be a good idea, and that at least in law, people should not use too much empathy. But if you have one last urge to be empathic before tuning down your empathy, like people who are quitting cigarettes have a last urge to have a last cigarette before tuning down their empathy. Perhaps you'd like to use this last urge in the question and answer session. Thank you very much.